Speaking on this program is Brother Winford Claiborne.
Thank you very much and good morning. A number of national surveys in recent months have shown that the American people think the nation is doing well. According to some experts, any time the economy seems to be healthy and growing, many people give a favorable rating to the political administration in power, even though most economists know there is no necessary connection between any administration and a good economy. Of course, if politicians and media pundits keep telling us there is a direct relationship between what the administration believes and does and a flourishing economy, millions of people are going to listen and believe it. The Tennessean, Saturday, December the 27th, 1997, published an article with the title, "Americans Believe Nation on Right Track," and was written by Chuck Rush of Gannett News Service. Rush says that almost two-thirds of the American people believe the country is on the right track. Page 1A. On the same page of the Tennessean, there was an article about Nashvillians who think the nation has a brighter future. Several people expressed considerable optimism about the nation's future. One man thought Nashville provided a good work environment, but expressed concern over some of Nashville's priorities. He said that sporting events had a higher priority than the well-being of the people. He was also concerned about indifference in caring for others. An older Nashville citizen was not too optimistic. He said the whole country was going to hell. He was very critical of the president for his lack of principles. Page 1A. I have read similar statements in other print media and have heard them on television and on radio. I must ask you a question. Is America on the right track? I'm not denying in any way the importance of a sound economy. But does a good economic situation mean the nation is on the right track? Are there not other conditions and ideas which must be considered before we proclaim to the world that our nation is on the right track? Do moral and spiritual values have any place in the well-being of a nation? In other words, might a nation be on the right track economically and on the wrong track morally and spiritually? Ben J. Wattenberg, a very influential thinker, presidential speechwriter, and public television personality, tells us in his 1995 book that values matter most. In fact, that is the title of Wattenberg's book. The subtitle of the book is How Republicans or Democrats or a Third Party Can Win and Renew the American Way of Life. A few excerpts from Wattenberg's excellent book should help us understand that our nation has made many wrong turns, at least according to Wattenberg, and I heartily agree with him. He writes, "I believe that the values situation in America has deteriorated. I believe that government has played a big role in allowing these values to erode." Page 10. If America founders, it will be on values, not economics. Page 393. Ben Wattenberg is an unusually perceptive writer, as can be seen by the following comments. President Clinton is in deep trouble on the betrayal issue and on personal matters. Page 385. When Democrats of my stripe think of the Clinton presidency, a single word comes to mind. Betrayal. Page 400. Incidentally, Ben Wattenberg has always been a liberal Democrat and wrote these comments on the state of our nation in 1995. I wonder what he would say in 1998. The Tennessean, Saturday, August the 22nd, 1998, reported that drug use among America's teenagers is on the rise. A national survey of 24,500 people revealed the following about drug use among teenagers. Teens are more likely to use illegal drugs if they are already using tobacco and alcohol. there was a significant increase in the number of teens who have smoked cigarettes in the past months. Almost 10% of the 12 to 13-year-olds smoked within the last year. Marijuana use is on the increase because many of America's young people believe it is not too dangerous. Donna Shalala, Secretary of Health and Human Services, says many parents are actually relieved when they learn that their children are smoking marijuana as opposed to using heroin or cocaine. She warns parents and young people that marijuana is not a soft drug and can hamper memory and learning. Page 13A. Millions of our young people are drinking regularly, and some are getting drunk weekly. Thousands of our children are killing themselves and others on our highways because they are addicted to alcohol. In addition, they are failing in school, on the job, and in their personal relationships. The future of young people who are addicted to alcohol and to other drugs is not very bright. Many of them will go through life neglecting their God-given talents, leading lives of crime and violence, and causing their families heartaches and headaches. At this time, there seems to be no light at the end of the tunnel in our dealing with alcohol and with other dangerous drugs. If you have a son or a daughter who is addicted to drugs and who is causing so much concern and sadness, is it of great comfort to you to know that our economy is prospering? Are we willing to sacrifice the welfare of our children for the financial stability of our nation? I'm not saying that we cannot have a healthy economy and good, strong citizens at the same time. But we do not have a good moral climate in our country at this time. I'm not trying to assess the blame for the increase in the use of alcohol and other drugs. But I am saying we are not on the right track in America. When drugs are doing so much damage to so many individuals and homes. Furthermore, we are not on the right track when we as families, as churches, as communities, and as the government are not doing more to change the drug abuse situation. A recent report says that 40 million babies have been destroyed by abortion since the infamous Roe decision in 1973. 40 million innocent babies killed primarily for the convenience of the mothers. I have no way of confirming or denying this number of babies murdered. But I suspect from all the reading I have done in this area that the number is substantially correct, give or take a million or two precious babies. Government reports state that between 1,500,000 and 1,600,000 babies are killed every year in their mother's wombs. The morality of this situation defies imagination. But let us forget, if we can, the morality of abortion for just a minute. What about the economy of killing so many of our citizens? No, I am not speaking of the enormous amount of money abortionists, Planned Parenthood, and hospitals make on the millions of abortions they perform. I am thinking of the economic impact the killing of 40 million people will have on the American economy in the years ahead. The children who were aborted in the first 2 or 3 years after abortion became legal would be 22 to 25 years of age. They would have been in various occupations and professions, making money to contribute to the tax rolls in local communities, in states, and in the federal government. They would be producing goods and services which would make our economy even stronger. In addition, they would be strengthening our weak social security system. Even if you are interested only in the economy, can you not see how seriously we have erred in killing 40 million babies? But abortion is not just a financial disaster. It is a moral tragedy for families and for the country. There is hardly any doubt that abortion has so desensitized the American people that they are not too disturbed when young couples kill their babies if they do not want them. If the couple could have killed their baby a month before it was born, and they could have legally, why should Americans be so concerned when they kill their babies minutes or hours after they are born? Is it possible abortion could lead to infanticide and to euthanasia? It may not, but I can think of no valid reason why it would not. When you think about what some have correctly called the abortion holocaust, do you still believe America is on the right track? What would we have to do to get on the wrong track? If America is on the right track, why is there so much violence among our children? The Tennessean, Tuesday, August the 11th, 1998, reported the murder of an 11-year-old child. The incident occurred in Chicago and involved two buddies, 7 and 8 years old. 7 and 8, not 17 and 18. The two little boys are charged with hitting the 11-year-old girl on the head, molesting her, and then suffocating her. What would motivate two boys to be so brutal and senseless? Was the 11-year-old girl cursing them, fighting them? They simply wanted her bicycle. Why not kill a little girl if she has a bicycle and you do not? Assistant Cook County State's Attorney Michael Oppenheimer called the little girl's death a brutal and shocking crime. Page 4A. I need not remind you of the senseless violence at Paducah, Kentucky, Pearl, Mississippi, Jonesboro, Arkansas, and in other schools across the country. You have no doubt kept up with these unspeakable tragedies. But they are typical of what is occurring in many communities throughout our nation. When thousands and thousands of our children are being killed by such vicious criminals, whether those criminals are young or old, does that suggest to you that America is on the right track? Can the very best economic situation in the world compensate for the loss of our children and our young people? Dr. William Bennett, who most of you know from his having served as Education Secretary under President Reagan and Drug Czar under President Bush, and Dr. John DeLulio, Jr., Professor of Politics and Public Affairs at Princeton, have written a new book which should be read by every parent and every other citizen concerned about America's young people. The book has the title, Body Count, Moral Poverty, and How to Win America's War Against Crime and Drugs. This book presents a very disturbing picture of juvenile crime in our country. These distinguished authors quote these words from Chief David G. Walchalk of Concord, New Hampshire. It is clear that youth violence has reached epidemic proportions that must be addressed. In 1993, law enforcement agencies made almost 2,400,000 juvenile arrests. If the present trends continue, the violent crime arrest levels alone will double by the year 2010. Page 20. Incidentally, Chief Walchalk is also president of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. A few brief excerpts from the book by Dr. Bennett and Dr. DeLulio should cause us to take notice of the juvenile crime confronting the United States. Males 14 to 24 are now about 8% of the population, but they constitute 27% of all homicide victims and 48% of all murderers. Page 22. A Philadelphia jury convicted three suburban teens of third-degree murder for beating an altar boy to death with baseball bats in front of his church. Page 23. A new generation of street criminals is upon us, the youngest, biggest, and baddest generation any society has ever known. Page 26. One final paragraph will have to suffice for today. Based on all that we have witnessed, researched, and heard from people who are close to the action, here is what we believe. America is now home to thickening ranks of juvenile super predators, radically impulsive, brutally remorseless youngsters, including ever more pre-teenage boys who murder, assault, rape, rob, burglarize, deal deadly drugs, join gun-toting gangs, and create serious communal disorders. They do not fear the stigma of arrest, the pains of imprisonment, or the pangs of conscience. They perceive hardly any relationship between doing right or wrong now and being rewarded or punished for it later. To these mean street youngsters, the words right and wrong have no fixed moral meaning. Page 27. Since I have been speaking with you about problems relating to teenagers, let me mention another problem which applies primarily, but not exclusively, to teenagers. I have in mind the enormous number of out-of-wedlock pregnancies. Some recent reports indicate that there may be a slight reduction in the number of teenage pregnancies. The reduction is very slight, but any improvement is certainly welcome. You know, even if you're not a Christian, that premarital sex is wrong, always wrong. But my concern today is over the hundreds of thousands of babies who are reared by teenage mothers without the aid and support of fathers. Every child born into this world deserves both a mother and a father. Where they are deprived of either, not only do the children suffer because of it, but so does society as a whole. Besides, of the 1 million babies conceived out of wedlock, 400,000 of them pay with their lives by being aborted. But what possible difference could all of this make if we are enjoying a healthy economy? We can forget about the thousands and thousands of lives which are ruined by out-of-wedlock pregnancies. We can overlook the irresponsibility of the fathers of those babies, fathers who want many of the benefits of being married, but none of the obligations of marriage. But if we have 2 cars in our garages, money in the bank, resources for several vacations each year, and a sufficient number of toys, who cares about the lives which are destroyed by immorality? Is the nation on the right track when approximately 50% of all marriages end in divorce? About 100 years ago, the number of divorces were about 5,000 per year in the United States. Even that figure is distressing when you remember the lives which are adversely affected by every divorce. In 1976, for the first time in the history of the United States, there were 1 million divorces. 1 million. 200 times the number of divorces which occurred about 100 years ago. That staggers the imagination. 2 million adults and approximately 1,700,000 children have their lives altered forever by divorce. Even if husbands and wives are devoid of moral values, they cannot escape the hurt of a divorce. And children who love both parents are marked for life. In many cases, they will wonder what they did or failed to do which drove their parents apart. Children do not deserve that kind of fate. Every child has a right to a father and a mother who love each other and love the children. That is God's arrangement and cannot be violated with impunity. As tragic as divorce is, there are other aspects of marriage which ought to be the cause of alarm among right-thinking people. I'm referring to the unhappy, joyless, and unfulfilling marriages. Dr. Joyce Brothers, a well-known psychologist and television personality, says that 1 of 12 marriages is what she calls a complete marriage, a marriage where the husband and wife truly love each other and find contentment in each other's company. If that figure is correct, and I have no way of confirming or denying it, it is a sad commentary on the state of marriage in our nation. How does one explain the condition of marriages in our country? Have the churches failed to preach and to enforce God's pattern for the home? Have fathers and mothers neglected to teach their children what it means to be a husband and a wife? Have television, the movies, and the printed media advocated, or at least accepted, the moral values of barnyard animals. If divorce and unhappiness in marriage were the only problems relating to the home, they would be serious enough. But that is not the whole story. Spouse abuse in almost every community has become a national disgrace. There are men who beat their wives, abuse them mentally and emotionally, and fail to provide the support, not just financial, their wives want and deserve. How can any man think he is a man when he attacks his wife, blacks her eyes, and sends her to the hospital? Only brutes and beasts abuse their wives. No decent man would ever do it. A good man might feel forced to leave his wife, but no man should ever, under any circumstances, hit his wife. Child abuse has also become a national disgrace in our country. Statistics on wife abuse or on child abuse are very difficult to obtain and notoriously unreliable. Both forms of abuse are almost certainly much higher than national surveys reveal. But we know there are between 2 million and 3 million children abused in the United States each year. Experts estimate that between 2,000 and 7,000 children die because of that abuse. Nobody knows how many children are seriously and permanently injured from abuse. How many die immediately or in subsequent years? How many children take their lives because of the abuse they suffer from parents or from guardians? And the turmoil and sadness which invariably accompany such abuse. There is hardly any tragedy which affects me emotionally more than child abuse. My heart goes out to these children and young people who almost certainly will never overcome the terrible effects of child abuse. Maybe divorce, marital unhappiness, spouse, and child abuse are not really all that serious. Is it possible I am disturbed by these conditions just because I am a preacher? If I were a politician whose main concern was the economy, maybe I could explain these matters in a more favorable light. Are religious people simply too sensitive and too Victorian or too narrow-minded? If we were just a little more broad-minded and less idealistic, maybe these tragic situations would not cause us so many heartaches. The popular notion seems to be, just get the economy going in the right direction and everything will be all right. Is anybody in my audience naive enough or hard-hearted enough to believe such claptrap? Like many of the older people in my audience today, I have lived through the civil rights movement. I have seen changes in the South I never dreamed possible 40 or 50 years ago. Who would have thought a half century ago that thousands of churches in the South would be integrated in this century? I seldom preach in revivals anywhere, in Tennessee, in Georgia, in Alabama, in Mississippi, and in Florida, that does not have a good number of blacks in attendance. The West Fayetteville Church of Christ does not discriminate on the basis of race. If it did, I would have no interest in preaching at West Fayetteville. God does not allow His people to discriminate against anyone on the basis of race. That was Peter's reason for saying at the house of Cornelius, "Of a truth I perceive that God is no respecter of persons, but in every nation he who fears Him and works righteousness is accepted with Him." Acts 10:34-35. While I have seen many changes occur in our nation, changes which ought to be welcome to all except members of the Klan and some of the militia groups, the changes are not broad enough and deep enough. It is not enough just to welcome people of other races, nations, social and financial conditions into the church. We must demonstrate our love for all people. God loves all people. We are all made in His image. How can we fail to love whom God loves? Most of our national leaders seem to be concerned about the blight of racism in the United States. But in too many cases, they either do not know what to do about it, or they do the wrong thing. When governmental leaders, either state or national, establish affirmative action programs or set-asides, they ought to know that these arrangements promote anger, bitterness, and bigotry. If a man is eliminated from a project because he is white, what is the difference between that and eliminating a man because he is black, or Hispanic, or Jewish, or Asian? Who can be so blind as to believe that discrimination of any kind will remedy the evil of discrimination? I have sketched for you today some of the moral and spiritual problems we face as a nation. All who have eyes to see can surely understand the seriousness of all of these problems. Why are politicians so blind that they, especially when they are running for office, will not address these truly tragic situations? If they really care about us as human beings and not just as votes, they must get involved in correcting the gross evils which are hurting so many people and can eventually destroy our democratic way of life. I do not mean to sound pessimistic, but a reading of the scriptures and other historical works should open some eyes. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the famous Russian dissident, was talking with an older man about the moral, social, and economic situation in the former Soviet Union. When Solzhenitsyn asked the older man what the heart of the problem was, the old man replied, "We have forgotten God." Do you see any evidence on the nightly news television shows, in the daily newspaper, in weekly magazines, and in our communities, that we have forgotten God, or perhaps that we never really knew God? Ben Wattenberg, from whom I read just a few minutes ago, says that it is not the social issues that are phony baloney. The economy is the snake oil issue, the smoke and mirrors issue. Page 92. Wattenberg vigorously denies what some prominent politicians have said. It's the economy, stupid. I close with this wise observation by Ben Wattenberg. If America founders, it will be on values, not economics. Page 393. Thank you for listening today, and may God continue to bless you.